painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking. KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Today's Artbeat is the continuation of our two-part interview and lecture series from Minnesota author Ashley Shelby, who wrote Red River Rising, The Anatomy of a Flood and the Survival of an American City. She will also talk about the processes of writing the book and getting it published. Here's Terry Tenseth with Ashley Shelby on today's Artbeat.
Now, you have influences, McPhee, Kerouac, which you mentioned earlier, Twain, which you quote in your book, and Hemingway. And how do all these guys get inside?
I know. It's like, how does Kerouac and Hemingway exist in the same library without killing each other? You know, they each gave me something different. You know, Kerouac, for me, he's the reason that I write. Because I just thought, I mean, first of all, I mean, just from a craft perspective, to me, there's so much beauty and tenderness in his prose. Yes, sometimes it can be sloppy. Sometimes it's a little too self-aware. But man, he made me think that I could write. And he is the reason I went to Columbia. And he's the reason that I, you know, made my first humiliating forays into writing. You know, and I mean, and they are embarrassing. And I saw Jennifer Egan, a novelist who won the National Book Award, and I think a Pulitzer this year. She said in an interview, you have to give yourself permission to write very badly. You have to, or you will not write. And I still, to this day, you know, I write very badly in order to just get to the next, say, chapter. Right. It's like, I don't know what to do here. Well, who cares? Just make it bad, because you're going to go back and rewrite. And Kerouac was notorious for never rewriting. He was very much against that. So that's where he and I parted ways. McPhee is just... my dad introduced me to McPhee, and some of his stuff I can say now. I never used to dare say it, but some of his stuff could be a little dry for me, but there are some things that are just unbelievable. He's there, but he's not there, and he focuses on the person. He focuses on the idea, and that's what I really like about him, his quietness on the page and his mastery of the craft. Twain, you know, humor. And also just, you know, his love of the river. It was very instructive to me when I was writing this book that there was precedent, that there were river communities that had been cut off in floods, and that there was a mentality of river towns. And he knew that mentality so well because he was from a river town. And then for me, Hemingway, it was just about discipline, you know, the discipline of the prose. I had a tendency when I was younger to write too big, you know, too purple, to try and impress with big words. And I think a lot of beginning writers do that.
Mm-hmm.
But Hemingway, obviously, you know, who is it said, I think it was Faulkner who said that Hemingway never wrote a word, never sent anybody reading his books to a dictionary, you know, and I actually think that's great praise.
Yes.
Because the writing's beautiful. And it's all that, a lot of his story happens in what's not there. And so that kind of discipline and that kind of asperity was very instructive to me as well. I can't say I write like Hemingway. I definitely don't. But I sometimes say that I'll read him if I see that my prose is getting too thick. And then, you know, there's this tendency that you'll start imitating the writers that you're reading. So I sometimes make a great effort not to read Kerouac if I'm writing myself. Oh, it's not like it's a great effort. You know what I mean? But it's like I will be sure not to read Kerouac when I am writing my own work, because then he'll infect my prose. But Hemingway, I don't mind reading when I'm writing, because he just brings it down just enough, brings it down a notch just enough where it's a little bit more clear.
It's kind of like listening to certain music makes you write angrier.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I do that too. That's true.
How did writing the book The Raging Red affect you emotionally?
Oh, well, I was exhausted at the end of it. And didn't ever want to talk about floods again. But then there was a huge uproar. Well, I shouldn't say it was an uproar, actually. It was one guy who was really just furious with me, and that was Mike Jacobs, who is the publisher of the Grand Forks Herald, only paper in town. And they became a character, and there were some things in the book that were not very flattering to him, and not in a mean-spirited way, just in a journalistic way. One of the things was that they won a Pulitzer for service. In newspaper, and that's given to a paper not for excellence of reporting, but because they published during a flood, for example. Well, I talked to a guy, you know, he's never given me permission to use his name, but he's a major media figure in St. Paul, and the St. Paul Pioneer Press printed their paper. So Grand Forks folks would, you know, type it up, mm-hmm. send it via computer to St. Paul Pioneer Press, both in the Gannett family, they would print it up and fly it in a Northwest Airlines plane up every single night to make sure the paper was there. Well, this person said to me, you know, not saying anything, but maybe that Pulitzer should have been split between the two papers. Well, for whatever reason, that made Mike Jacobs really angry. And like I was saying, that the Herald wasn't an excellent paper, even though if you read the book, I say it all the time. But there's also, you know, the fact that, you know, he sort of, there's just a lot of incidents in there where he was, the way that he treated Pat Owens in an interview, for example, or whatever. So he, it was just a very interesting experience, very instructive for me, where he hired, for some reason, a woman who appears like in the first page of my acknowledgments to review my book. She was an associate professor at UND. This woman was nice to me. She'd sent me reams of oral history and only asked me to reimburse her the postage. I mean, it was really nice. I sent her a box of chocolates. You know, we were on good terms. Then I see this. It's in like World War II font on the back of the Grand Forks Herald, the image of my book, and it says River of Errors. And I'm thinking, error? Like, what errors are you talking about? Because this went through like copy editing, proofing, plus the review board, plus three professors of history from UN, from North Dakota. So I'm curious, what are these mistakes? And I was hoping they weren't the same ones that Jacobs pointed out in his certified letter, because those were actually not mistakes. He was wrong, except for, you know, his house being damaged. But that wasn't my assertion. That was a National Weather Service employee's assertion. Anyway, so I'm reading this review, again, like as a very, very young person who's just literally given everything she had to create this book and get it right. And it was like a very bizarre review. You should look it up sometime, where this woman said that I owed the city of Grand Forks an apology because I left out the apostrophe in Devil's Lake, which actually only happened once. I found like other, I went through the book obsessively, and other times they were spelled correctly. Misspelling the governor of North Dakota's name, even though she misspells the governor's name in her own review, saying that because I omitted a couple other bookstores, a couple bookstores in Grand Forks, that they should boycott my book and not stock it in Grand Forks. And it was just like the smallness of it was bizarre. Like I said in my speech, she could have really gotten me for some other things that she didn't. And I'm thinking, okay, you're saying that my book is humiliating to me because copy editing errors. So what's, and plus I like you. What is going on?
Yeah.
So that was devastating at the time because it was just not, I didn't foresee it. And then what made it more devastating was that my publishers were very scared of Mike Jacobs and they didn't want me to respond.
So your heart just dropped.
It was hard. Yeah. Especially because it felt like so unfair because there were so many errors in her review. She didn't understand hydrology. So she said things like, Des Moines will be very surprised to learn that it's on the Mississippi River. Well, no, I never said that. I said that it suffered in the Mississippi floods of 93 because it's a tributary of the Mississippi River and it's in the Mississippi River watershed. And yes, it suffered in the Mississippi floods of 93. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so, but I couldn't come back point by point like that with her. And they just wanted me to say, well, you caught some minor copy editing errors, but you missed the main point about the National Weather Service. And because I'm young and I didn't stick up for myself, you know, because my publisher didn't want me to. Well, to add insult to injury, the day that my letter to the editor appeared in tiny font, he wrote, Mike Jacobs wrote a big editorial about how snotty I am. We've never even spoken. I mean, we spoke on the phone where I meekly asked him for an interview. We've never spoken.
And you're shy.
Yeah.
Self-proclaimed shy.
I am not. I mean, I don't know. Snotty is, you know, that's very subjective, but I certainly was almost kissing his foot. I wanted an interview. So, you know, stuff like that where you can't win. Because you're just an author and he's the publisher of a newspaper, no matter how wrong he is and how mean-spirited it is. And it was so odd that the Star Tribune picked up the story and said, this is very weird. You know, this reviewer recommends her own book instead of Shelby's in this review.
That's so weird.
And so for me, that was, when you talk about emotionally, that bothers me to this day because it doesn't seem fair. And I have often wanted to ask this reviewer, why did you do it? Were you asked to do it? And, you know, I never got one of the review board people, one of the professors did come to me privately. She's not supposed to reveal herself to me, but she did. And she works at the same university as this person. And she said that she was absolutely floored and disgusted by it. And I don't know if she's achieved tenure or not. I don't know if she will. I mean, that stuff, you know.
It gets around.
It gets around. And also just the bizarreness of it. I mean, I've seen harsh reviews, and my book could easily, I could write a harsh review of my own book. But not on those points. Those points were odd. She didn't talk about the National Weather Service situation at all. And that, to me, is very odd because that's a core of the book. Mm-hmm. So, and then it was funny when I went up to Grand Forks to speak when I was on my book tour. I was speaking at the North Dakota Museum of Art, and I was just sort of looking at the pictures. Every picture of Devil's Lake, the museum staff had written Devil's Lake with an apostrophe. And I was just like, God, that's so ironic, you know? It was just, man. So, but what that did teach me, though, was that you have to be certain that there's no mistakes. I mean, having been an editor, the Devil's Lake thing is a copy editing error, and that's something a copy editor should have caught. But I'm not going to throw my copy editor under the bus. That was not something I was willing to do. She should have caught Schaefer, you know, and that had happened at Penguin, it would have been the copy editor's head. You know, the editor would have been furious because she didn't have time to line edit. That's a copy editor's job. But it was my fault at the end of the day. You know, I put an apostrophe in Devil's Lake. I shouldn't have. I misspelled the governor's name. I shouldn't have, because it gave someone who otherwise had no valid criticism a foothold to humiliate me. And I was humiliated. You know, I mean, just imagine a full page, full color, four color river of errors as a 23-year-old who literally worked for two years straight on a book.
It was heart-wrenching.
Yeah, only to have it taken apart because of a misplaced apostrophe and a disputed date on when classes were let out at UND to fight the flood. So,
and that's where you learn to stick up for yourself, probably.
It's too late for me to do it for this book now, but if that were to ever happen in the future, without hesitation. And I still don't understand why my publisher didn't want to do that, because we're talking about a small-town newspaper.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And if anything, he made my book a hotter commodity in Grand Forks than it should have been. People read that. And, you know, I had people's opinions on all the different, you know, figureheads in Grand Forks, and people had opinions about Mike Jacobs, and they were never positive. And yeah. So for him to be angry, that really piqued people's interest. And they wanted to know what he was so mad about. And I hope that if they did pick up the book, they'll understand that it's very hard when you're a writer, typically writing about other people, to finally be written about yourself. And how you handle it, I think, is a measure of who you are as a person. And there absolutely was one error about him, and that was that his home was not, he claims anyway, it was not damaged in the flood. But, you know, a National Weather Service employee said that to me, and I would have followed up if he had responded to any of my requests for interviews. But, you know, if I hadn't made that mistake, he probably would have found something else.
Sounds like it.
But, you know, at the end of the day, these were my mistakes. They shouldn't be there. And I would have saved myself a lot of heartache if I had just found them and corrected them. But, you know, what's done is done.
It's the process.
It's definitely a process. And it's a learning process. And I learned so much from that experience, as painful as it was, as unfair as it feels. I learned a lot, and I learned what not to do next time.
Well, hey, that's worth it in itself. It's an education.
Fine-tooth comb. You know what I mean? Doesn't matter how many times you've gone over it, how right you think you are. Just double-check, always double-check names and dates. But to base a whole angry review on copy editing errors, it just makes me think that it was a directed review from the publisher of the paper, because she gave me no sense that she felt that way when she was helping me write the book. And some people have suggested that, you know, it scooped her own book. She was working on a book about the flood. But even more reason to not be the reviewer of the book.
You know what I mean? You're too close.
Yeah. So, no, but it feels nice to say it, to talk about it. I'm actually glad that I didn't get to it in depth in my presentation, because you know, look, I've talked about it to you for 10 minutes. I mean, I could have gone on for a lot longer, you know, in front of the audience, because I've never spoken about it before. And it feels good to do it, because I wasn't allowed to do it when I was, in the midst of it. My publisher didn't want to do it, didn't want to engage him, so.
Can't control you now.
No. I mean, what's the point? I mean, it's not like this book didn't sell very well either. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, It hasn't sold very many copies, and which is fine, because, you know, I didn't write it to publish it, actually. I wrote it to graduate from my graduate school. You know, it'd be nice if it sold more copies, not because I want any royalty checks, but because I think that it could help a few people in flood-ravaged communities. I mean, there were horrible floods in Australia last year, and I remember thinking, God, you know, they'd know that there is the like what to expect if they read part of this book, you know. But, you know, what are you going to do?
Well, that's what you can hope that people get take from your work is some insight.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I mean, that's the bottom line. It's not, this book isn't, I don't see it as about Grand Forks. I see it as about communities recovering from disaster, just told from a specific, you know, event, you know, that could really be a stand-in for any event. I did, you know, I had a few magazines call me after Katrina to talk to me about how a community recovered from disaster. And it's very interesting to see how, even on a much larger scale, New Orleans has been going through sort of the same issues mm-hmm. with the redevelopment and the homes being razed from, you know, the lower Ninth Ward, I believe it is. And, you know, they have a lot of other complicating factors, but the elected officials losing their jobs because people are so dissatisfied. And, you know, it's just something that happens with every disaster, really. You know, and actually, Pat Owens would get phone calls from other mayors of cities that had suffered disasters and then had lost their re-election bid, warning her that this was going to happen. And she's like, no, it won't. What are you talking about? It's not going to happen. Not in Grand Forks. And of course, that's exactly what happened.
Now that you've gotten to know Ashley Shelby, the writer, it's time for the second half of her lecture on the Red River Rising, presented at the Minnesota Marine Art Museum this summer. You're listening to ArtBeat.
Here, I'll just read a little bit of what I'm talking here about flood angst. Though often discussed in terms of natural phenomena, disasters are largely social products, a kind of pathology in the everyday sociology of a community. A natural process, a flood, for example, only becomes disaster when human lives are affected. And human lives are affected by a natural event only when those human lives and the force of nature intersect, as in a floodplain. The problem in Grand Forks was that few were aware of or wanted to admit to the city's vulnerability to a flood. They simply didn't believe it. The land around Grand Forks was littered with the imagery of destruction. Bloated cattle and hog carcasses, sewage-clogged streets, 10-foot deep holes where homes used to be. Even Mayor Pat Owens became a flood icon, inseparable from the disaster. In a flood, loss does not occur all at once, and perhaps there is something almost merciful about losing everything at once. The first Christmas after the flood, people in Grand Forks discovered the flood was still robbing them. Every holiday season, Peg Rogers' mother had made krumkaki for her children and then for her grandchildren. These thin Norwegian cookies are made with a mold called a krumkaki iron. That Christmas, when Peg's mother remembered that her krumkaki irons had been lost in the flood, she was inconsolable. One of Peg's friends found an old iron in her garage and offered it as a substitute. We told Mom it doesn't have the old memories, but we can create new ones. During the first weeks following the flood, it seemed the act of telling one's personal flood story comforted the wounded. Accounts of lost houses, dead pets, ruined family heirlooms were shared in the shelters, in FEMA lines, in grocery stores. Everyone listened, and when it was their turn, reciprocated with their own story of heartbreak. In the beginning, the damaged people of Grand Forks believed the flood had been an instant terrible leveler. People from the working class neighborhoods, for instance, were quietly amused to see folks in the wealthier neighborhoods sprinting outside when the Red Cross food truck pulled up to the curb and eagerly taking their ration of hot dogs. But mostly the comfort in the commiseration took the form of a laundry list of loss. And after the garbage had been cleared away, the definition of loss expanded to include intangibles like security, trust, and hope. The University of North Dakota had already assembled an oral history interview team to gather flood stories, but flood fatigue had set in, that bone-deep exhaustion people would still feel years later. One interviewer approached a man at a picnic. "What do you think about the flood?" the interviewer asked. "I try not to." "How do you not think about it? What do you do to not think about it?" "Well," he replied, "one thing I do is try not to talk about it. If I do, I try not to dwell on it for very long because I feel we have to move on. It's over and done with, and there's nothing we can do about it now except to make sure that it doesn't happen again," he said. "Did you lose a lot?" "I lost my business and half my home, but as long as my family's all together and no one was hurt, we'll go on." "There's no help for you, was there, for business?" "Very little," the man said, "so very little." "What do? Just close it up, smile, go on." "No wonder you don't want to look back," the interviewer said. "There's nothing to look at." "Nothing to look at," the man said. Flood angst could also apply generally to the five stages of grief transposed to a disaster-affected community: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. But in Grand Forks, the first among these was anger, and it seemed an exceptionally virulent strain.
Kelly Straub, who was a woman I follow through the course of the book, a homeowner in Lincoln Drive. Kelly Straub, for example, would, 4 years after the flood, still call Pat Owens evil. "You know what Pat Owens was? She was a puppet on strings," Kelly said. She also accepted as fact, as did Jim and Mary Lean, another couple that I follow throughout the course of the book, that the city council, city engineer, and mayor had had advance warning of the severity of the flood and chose not to pass it on to their constituents. "They needed it to be so bad in order to get the funding," Kelly said. "You see what I mean? You need to have a disaster that is worth billions before government steps in and help you out. If they would have told people flood's coming, plan on water, people would have moved crap out of their house like crazy. They would have gone to high ground. You weren't warned. Nobody was told of anything, except for, did you know every single council member did not have a single drop?" This is what Kelly Straub was telling me. "And they will swear up and down that it's everybody else's fault. Everybody else's fault." Kelly Straub looks you in the eye when she says this. She is dead earnest. Kelly is not by far the only person in Grand Forks who believes that the city conspired to hide information that even hydrologists, Mike Anderson, Steve Bune, and anyone else at the North Central River Forecasting Center did not have. It was a conspiracy, they believed, to allow a disaster of such magnitude that federal government would be obligated to step in and help them resuscitate a dying city. So that right there is a symptom of that flood angst. Kelly was a very interesting case study. She was a woman, a mother, single mom who lived in the Lincoln Drive neighborhood, and she was the last person to move out. She had a house that was absolutely a disaster, unfit for human habitation, but she would not leave, and she was angry. She came to also be a bit of a talisman for some of the people in Grand Forks. So the interview, after I finally secured that interview, I went to Chanhassen, the North Central River Forecasting Center, and I met Mike Anderson and Steve Bune and a guy named Daniel Luna. I had spoken to the folks at the Grand Forks office. That was not a problem to get that interview because they were not really in charge of any of the forecasting. The forecasting for the Red River Valley takes place in this sort of industrial park in Chanhassen in a large building. And that's where I went for for the interview. This ended up being the meat of the book for me. And it was really what I had slaved over. And really, in my opinion, the only real new thing in the book. There have been histories written about the Red River floods. They're not narrative like my book is, but you can get all different aspects of the flood experience in other books. But this, for me, this was the one thing that was new. And I can't overemphasize how important this element of the book was to me and what I had done to prepare for this single four-hour interview and how nervous I was because I was coming in sort of as the bad guy. They were expecting me to not know anything about what I was talking about, not understand hydrology, and to want to try and get them. So they were a little standoffish when I sat down. They were still receiving death threats. These guys grew up in the Red River Valley. That was another thing that to me was very interesting. You know, Mike Anderson grew up in the Red River Valley. He felt like he couldn't return. And I think he's returned since, but you know, there was just so much anger and he sort of had to clamp down and just not give interviews anymore. So they sort of sat down with me and started going through basic hydrology 101. And I nodded politely, I remember, and I said to him, "I guess my first question would be why the rating curve showed a loop at the East Grand Forks gauge." And when I said that, because by that time I had been able to see this rating curve, which is just a simple graph that shows the rise and fall of the river, which was sort of the key as to why the forecast was off. But anyway, when I said that, something in the room changed, and they realized that I might know a little bit more than they expected, that I might be able to give them a fair shake, that they might be able to explain the complexity of this because I had prepared, and I honestly can't say if I would have prepared as well if I hadn't been forced to wait for those FOIA documents. So I'm really glad for those delays because I could have gone in and really embarrassed myself. So anyway, they said, you know, well, let's start, let's talk, let's play ball. And, you know, they went through their experiences with the flood. They showed me this loop on the rating curve, which it's a kind of a complicated thing. It's in my book, but it was something that they absolutely could not have predicted. Basically, the river rose, it peaked, and then it dropped, and then it rose again unexpectedly, and they didn't expect that to happen. And it creates a loop on a rating curve. The rating curve sort of tells them, okay, well, here's where it's going to crest. And it's part of a computer model. It isn't a computer model, but it's a simple tool in a computer model. Well, when it loops, you can't see that loop until after the event. So they actually had absolutely no idea why their forecast was wrong until after the event, and they were able to look at that rating curve after the river had completely had started to go down for good and see that loop. But the most important thing I learned when I interviewed was obviously, you know, what had gone wrong, but also that these were men with families who'd grown up in the Red River Valley and who were heartsick. Something that I hadn't learned in all of my research and in reading articles about their forecasting. Mike Anderson's business card does not have the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration seal printed on it, as his colleague Steve Bunes does. Instead, below his name, position, and office address at the North Central River Forecast Center is a drawing of a tiny drenched dog sitting in a pool of water and looking forlorn. The hydrologist doesn't say the dog is his alter ego, but if you know Anderson's story, you don't have to ask. Mike Anderson grew up in Wahpeton, North Dakota, the headwaters of the Red River of the North. He spends so much time on the North Dakota side of the Red River, despite living in a Minneapolis suburb, that his boss, Daniel Luna, says he chooses not to ask Mike in which state he files his tax return. Anderson is a handsome man with white hair and a mustache, is unreservedly kind and well-liked among the hydrologists at the NCRFC. In 1997, Anderson was the primary National Weather Service forecaster for the Red River of the North. Each of the NCRFC's 16 river forecasters is responsible for one primary river basin. In addition, each serves as a backup forecaster for a secondary basin and must be equally well-versed in that area. Anderson's second basin, for example, was the nearby Shuri River, and he knew it well. He knew it as well as he knew the Red. Moreover, it would not be unusual for Mike Anderson to swap rivers with colleagues Steve Buhn and Mike DeWeese. The hydrologists are expected to be able to handle any river in the entire North Central forecast area, which stretches from Michigan to Missouri, from North Dakota to Indiana. In 1997, however, the NCRFC assigned five hydrometeorologists and hydrologic forecasters to the Red River full-time. The Red is a different animal, Mike Anderson said years later. It was his way of explaining why one quarter of the NCRFC's staff was assigned to a single river in a forecast area of 850 rivers and tributaries during flood season. On a typical day, Anderson might attend meetings, work on peripheral projects, and then hunker down to study, analyze, and forecast for his basin. During flood season, when he arrived for his shift in the morning, he analyzed data that had arrived overnight. River data, precipitation data, snowmelt data, and so on, then ran it through the runoff model. And then he started asking himself questions, lots of them. Is that data correct? This is what he told me. Is that data correct? Does it follow in line? If you had a 10-foot jump in the river and there hasn't been any rain there or snowmelt for the last month, you know that possibly, probably, that gauge is sending us the incorrect river data. We need to check this because that doesn't look right. Can you get us supplemental data? We normally don't get river data from this location because it's not a forecast point. It's not even a data point. But we'd really like to know what's going on there. Then, if all the data is right, you get into the guts of the model. Is it routing the water from Wahpeton to Fargo at the correct rate? Is this looking good? As spring runoff approached, these were the kinds of questions Mike Anderson was asking himself about the information he was receiving about the animal for which he was responsible. In short, he was doing what he had done for more than 20 years, and he was good at it. It would be tough to overestimate the importance of the National Weather Service and weather prediction in general to the river community of Grand Forks during a winter of such mythic proportions, and a flood that was, according to Frank Richards, the head of the agency's Hydraulic Information Center, an act of God. But the rating curve, perhaps the simplest tool in Mike Anderson's toolbox, came to bear a heavy burden. As time passed, blame was ascribed to elements that had not been identified earlier, elements that had become apparent only after months of scrutiny. By far the most important variable in the 1997 Grand Forks flood was a loop, as neat as a girl's hair bow, on the rating curve, caused when the river does not fall in the same pattern in which it has risen. Mike Anderson and Steve Buhn momentarily suspected a loop in the rating curve as they scrambled for answers the night of Thursday, April 17th. But okay, Anderson said, what do you do with it? Where's the loop? The loop was invisible. It could only be seen after the event when someone at the U.S. Geological Survey took the actual flood numbers from that event and drew a graph. A looped rating curve is a difficult concept to explain to the public. It's especially difficult for a group of people used to working in what seems like a shadowy private club with its own argot. Every once in a while, though, they are compelled to stumble out of that club, squinting into the bright sunlight of the real world, and put into intelligible terms what went wrong. The National Weather Service told the North Dakota Congressional delegation that, quote, extrapolation of the rating curve did not account for the anomalous behavior of the stage discharge relation at levels higher than any previous observations. And that's part of their problem prior to this flood event. What does that even mean? You know, you would have to be well-versed in hydrology to understand what they were saying. Mike Anderson could explain it better. And this is what he did for me in that conference room. 4 years after the flood, Anderson stood next to a whiteboard in the conference room of the NCRFC, picked up a red marker, and began to draw the Red River of the North the way most good hydrologists would, in terms of its slope. The Red River drops a foot a mile from Wahpeton to Grand Forks, he said, as he begins moving the marker across the whiteboard in a mild downward slope. You're going from Wahpeton to Fargo, and you're going down, 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 and pretty soon you're doing this. Anderson now dragged his red marker across the board slowly, drawing what appeared to be a heart monitor's flat line. The Red's course at Grand Forks had, in essence, reached the bottom of the fossil Lake Agassiz and would run quite some time before heading up its north beach. Big change, he said. This can easily cause a lot of backwater. If the water isn't leaving as fast as it's coming in, it's going to start to back things up. This is important because most flooding rivers rise and fall following the same pattern. Say the river's rising, Anderson said. At 20 feet, it's flowing at, for the sake of argument, say 2,000 cubic feet per second. When it comes back down and reaches 20 feet again, the volume of that river is 2,000 cubic feet per second, just a straight line, no guessing whatsoever. Mike Anderson had just described what the United States Geological Survey rating curve for the Red River at Grand Forks looks like, what every rating curve looks like, a single value rating curve, which, like most basic mathematical curves, is a best fit curve. Each point on the graph represents an actual measurement of the river's discharge and stage made at some point in time by the USGS, usually over a period of record, in Grand Forks' case, 117 years. So put another way, a flood usually behaves in the way a baseball thrown straight up into the air appears to do. It goes up and then it follows the same path down. That's what the Red